Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to Regulating AI, the podcast where we delve into the complex landscape of AI regulation, seeking to ensure that the future of AI is fair, transparent, and responsible. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have a distinguished guest who's at the forefront of shaping AI policy to center civil rights as a core issue. Joining us is Kaustubh K.J. Bagchi, the Vice President of the Center for Civil Rights and Technology at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. The Leadership Conference has a rich history dating back to its founding in 1950, rooted in the commitment to social justice and the power of coalition building. KJ brings a wealth of experience and insight into the conversation around AI regulation, advocating for policies that prioritize civil rights in the face of rapid technological advancement. We are all thrilled to have him here today to share his expertise and perspectives. KJ, thank you so much for joining the Regulating AI podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Sanjay.
Wonderful. KJ, to our global listeners, can you provide them with an overview for the Center for Civil Rights and Technology and its mission?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, as you referenced, was founded in the 1950s. This was the same time that Dr. Martin Luther King and his allies were marching on Washington. And during the same time, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights was formed to focus on the legislative part of implementing and enforcing civil rights protections. And so that started with the Voting Rights Act and then continued on through the other sort of major pieces of legislation we've seen as it impacts civil rights, in the US mainly. And so with the sort of progression of the intersections of where civil rights conversations are going right now, whether it's housing, access to education, access to credit, financial services, even decisions around healthcare, all of it is having some sort of intersection with automated systems or AI. And so last September 2023, the center was formally launched and announced. And then I took on the role in late October as vice president to sort of continue the media and technology work that the Leadership Conference was always undertaking, but to really build out a full-on center, the first of its kind for a legacy civil rights organization, to really attack this sort of and to be engaged in the issues around AI and civil rights, from a holistic standpoint. And so we've been building up our team. We've been engaging on issues beyond just the sort of what we're seeing in the headlines, and really trying to make sure that civil rights and any sort of protections and guardrails are in place when we talk about AI governance.
Well, that's fantastic. It's a one of its kind organization, as you said, KJ. KJ, as you said, talked about the guardrails. What do you think are the most pressing civil rights issues concerning the rapid advancement of AI technologies?
I think, it's important to remind your listeners that we've already seen the impact, the negative impact of AI on the civil rights of individuals, right? We've heard about individuals being denied access to housing or, even getting financing to buy a house because of automated systems. They've been denied health insurance claims. Mm-hmm. And we've also seen in the criminal justice system that though that facial recognition technology, another AI powered tool, has been the sort of basis for individuals being wrongfully arrested. So, it's important to point out that, look, the conversation around generative AI last year really kind of infused everyone to focus on AI as if it's this new thing. But the truth is it's been around, and automated systems have been around for quite some time, to the impact of even making human-like decisions, right? Which is our sort of thinking of AI is more than just a simple sort of machine learning, but are you making human-like decisions that impact individuals' lives? So this has already been happening for quite some time. And so for us, it is critical when we think about these systems, we look at it in sort of different parts, right? The first is when you're actually developing the system, the product, the tool. The second is when you actually deploy it. And the third is, based on those results, what are you actually doing with the system? So doing impact assessments, really making sure that the data you're using to power and develop these systems are actually coming from legally obtained, you know, folks have given consent and so on, ensuring that's part of that process, being clear about what's the purpose of this system and are you actually developing something that's meeting that goal. And then once it's deployed, ensuring that there's monitoring and transparency and understanding, okay, like this is the decision that it's making, this is the impact it's having. And finally, that third part, what do you do once you've determined what has actually been done? So if you find out that this system is actually coming out with discriminatory, you know, results for people of color, for let's say African-Americans or, you know, Asians, are you keeping the system on the market? Are you using the tool still, or are you completely taking it offline, reassessing and bringing it back into, you know, we say the word compliance, but there really isn't a strong set of sort of AI governance tools yet to follow. But like the idea there is, again, that's how we're thinking about sort of how do you think through protecting individuals from negative impacts. There's a whole list of principles I could point you to as well. We've, you know, in our coalition entry points, we have a number of coalition groups that we work with. We've listed out a number of principles: fairness, accountability, transparency. But the basic point, the fundamental point that we're really pushing is that no system should be used as a basis for a discriminatory result.
Wow. So that's a pretty big charter that you have, KJ. You're talking about right from the beginning of building these foundation models to complete implementation and use. So just for my understanding and our listeners,
sure,
are you engaged at all parts of the distribution of information, whether it is when the foundation, let's just talk about how they train the data, the foundation models. A lot of people have issues with how the data is being trained, whether it's issues of privacy, bias, etc. Talk to our listeners. Are you engaged, or are there concerns you have regarding how the data is being trained right now?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the joke I make, and I made this joke on the panel I referenced, I was telling you about offline, the impact panel last week. Sure. You know, to me, AI is really privacy and more fancy clothing, right? I think the idea of these systems are they're all powered by data. And the conversations we were having in like 2018, 2019, and even now we're sort of seeing another resurgence of a comprehensive privacy bill going through Congress. We were, you know, in before I even joined the leadership conference, I was working for another civil rights organization on tech issues. This is the basis of like what our conversations were about, right? This is, we were definitely thinking through how is data obtained? Do folks have the ability to understand when they're interacting with any kind of product or tool that the tool is sucking up its, you know, this personal data and this is how it's going to be used? And do you have the ability, do you have the right to have that information deleted? Do you have the right to transparency, knowing how long that data will be actually be stored on you? So yeah, again, yes, 100% we've been, you know, involved in those conversations. And I should point out that, look, the center was launched, you know, in September, but as I referenced, it's continuing the work that the leadership conference did in tech space. So while AI is on everyone's mind right now, we work on other tech policy issues, right? We work on privacy, we work on broadband access, we work on platform accountability. So, you know, kind of bringing us to the frame of AI and how data is collected, absolutely. We've definitely been involved in those conversations. And, you know, I think I join a lot of my civil society friends in arguing that we can talk about AI governance all we want, but until we have a strong foundation for how data should be collected, the governance, it will be important, but, you know, it topples, right? If you don't have a strong foundation, something topples over. And so I think that is going to be a critical conversation for those of us in the policy fight to have as well.
So KJ, when you're talking to, you know, the handful of companies that have large foundation models, how receptive do you find them towards what you're, I mean, being receptive, but how engaged are they in addressing some of the things that you talked about?
Yeah, you know, this is a question we get quite a bit, right? Because as a civil rights organization, especially in the tech space, you know, a lot of companies see us as sort of the one-stop shop. And it's not just the leadership conference staff, but, you know, we have a coalition of 240 organizations that maybe focus on a constituency that that company is really trying to reach, right? We have organizations that focus on the Spanish-speaking communities, on the AAPI community, the African-American community, as well as, you know, people with disabilities and so on. So for us, we engage a lot with companies. And I do want to point out that it's not only the sort of big tech companies that are chatting with us and saying, this is how we're thinking about AI governance internally. It is also the sort of the ride sharing companies, the home sharing companies. You have the smaller AI companies that are, you know, coming, you know, I'm trying not to blow anyone's spot up because a lot of these conversations are under NDA and private. But again, we are talking to folks across the board from big tech, to smaller entry points. And look, everyone's receptive. I think the challenge, and we may talk about this later, the challenge is these are all companies, right? At the end of the day, they're all in the private sector. They all have shareholders and they have board members to sort of respond to. And so while good governance is something that as a value that all these companies are getting a lot of attention for now, right? Like, are they following good these values around civil rights and just generally around making sure that if a decision is made that can impact someone's life, are these companies thinking through how to avoid that? They're all receptive. I think the implementation, the execution part is always where we see mixed results. And again, I think that is the tension between wanting to do the right thing because you know your users will benefit from this. But at the same time, you know, let's take the example of data collection. We know there was a point, maybe not now, right? But Cambridge Analytica and all this can't happen in the 2016 election.
Right.
We know that the data practice is there, the data broker practice is there, that you know, Facebook, before it became Meta, was involved with, was created all this harmful impact on our democracy, right? Yep. Creating misinformation, disinformation, and so on. So there's a shift in company culture based on what the feedback is. We definitely have been involved in more conversations than I would say, you know, when I joined this space in 2017. But I do think that, again, what execution looks like is critical. And I do think that's where legislation is going to be the final purveyor of what the results look like. It's not, you know, companies can have good intent, but if you don't have congressional, you know, passed bills, that's going to be an issue. I will quickly point out that the AI executive order that came out in October of last year, because it impacts vendors that are doing business with government, we are starting to see some impact there, right? There are procurement guidelines that are kind of coming into play. So again, do companies want to do the right thing? I'm not, you know, there are folks in our space that are very critical of companies' intentions and so on. Prior to coming to a leadership conference, I was at a tech industry trade association. So I know the folks that are involved in these big tech companies individually, personally, and everyone wants to do the right thing at that level. But do I think governance creates guardrails and, you know, it doesn't matter about intention at that point? Now you are doing the right thing because it is ingrained in law. So the executive order has been a major shift in the conversation around what companies have to do. But as we all know, executive orders don't impact private sector, you know, it doesn't impact private sector as a whole. And it only, you know, how many companies are actually playing with the federal government, right? It's probably the big tech companies that we already know about. So again, impact is going to be important.
So KJ, since you talked about the executive order and the legislation, the EU has passed the EU AI Act, and we have had over 200 bills that have gone through U.S. Congress, as you know very well. And then Senator Schumer, the majority leader, has had many of these listening sessions. I'm sure you've been part of some of them. But then recently he came out with something saying we need $32 billion. And that looks like basically it. Maybe there's going to be some bills that Senator Klobuchar might come out regarding election interference, etc. What are your thoughts on where we are at right now?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I think especially given the fact that your audience, right, is sort of sitting in a global perspective.
Yep.
The biggest thing that I remind folks, whether I'm on panels or speaking, you know, casually among friends, is that, you know, the EU system and even the culture and the thought process around privacy, as again, we talked about the foundation of all these things that we're mentioning today. The conversation around privacy and just as a cultural value in Europe, like I'm not a historian, but I would argue that it is a value. It is held to a higher standard, right? What is my privacy as an individual? And so I think what you saw with GDPR and that sort of movement was a critical part of that culture connecting to the legislative process there. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, again, EU AI Act, I do think Europe moves faster on some of these, you know, technological sort of system, governing technological systems than the US does. I think the challenge for the US on the, you know, US legislative side is that there the same culture does not exist. I think the conversations around AI governance or privacy, anything in the tech policy space, quickly devolves into innovation versus equity. And, you know, I think you're seeing Senator Schumer and the Senate generally trying to be like, all right, fine, we're gonna slow feed, you know, the public a sort of AI framework. We're gonna call it a roadmap. We're not gonna call it legislation. It's a roadmap. And if you read it carefully, you see that a lot of the points raised are very sort of broad and general. You know, take one example of like liability, like who's liable, a developer or deployer? And the language in the roadmap says, well, you know, committees should think through whether or not additional standards are created. And so because you have this sort of slow feeding the public overall AI governance, you see the committees taking a sort of piecemeal approach, right? So Klobuchar's, you know, three voting rights bills that made it mm-hmm. through markup, you know, are a good example of that, right? And it's leaving it to our American legislative process, but the politics of, are you pro-industry or are you anti-industry? And I see that clearly, being someone who came from the civil rights space, but spent some time in the private sector, working with these companies directly as a trade association, government affairs, you know, sort of professional, and then coming back to the civil rights part of the conversation, I've seen that the divide is vast. And I think the challenge here is people are looking at anything coming out of Congress, and that gets a sort of a target on its back. So the AI roadmap, I think it's important to remind your listeners that it's not legislation at all, right? There's no mandate. It's literally trying to take those AI fora conversations and trying to put it into something in a bipartisan basis. And so, you know, a lot of us were not surprised that the focus was, well, let's think about government investment, and that $32 billion that you quoted is what came up. But then conversations around governance were sort of put in the back burner. And that's why you see a lot of folks, including, you know, our organization, came out critically saying, look, there's nothing in this roadmap talking about prevention of harms. There's nothing talking about mitigation of harms. There's nothing talking about, like, what is the remedy once harm has occurred? What does a private right of action mean for an individual who's been harmed by one of these systems and wants to take action? So again, I would say that in terms of the global race on governance, I would say that EU is, you know, way much, much more advanced. In terms of analyzing whether I think the similar provisions would work in a domestic sense, you know, I think that I'll leave that to the experts to kind of do that comparative basis. But for me, as someone who's worked in, you know, the sort of policy space for, you know, over a decade now in the US, I think our politics around tech policy governance is just always going to have a difficult, tricky, you know, kind of status. And that's why it's important for all of us in the ecosystem, those of us in the civil rights space, those of us in the sort of tech rights space, to continue to push on these principles.
KJ, you made some fantastic points. Do you think, if you look at what Senator Schumer, Senator Rounds, and Senator Young, and Senator Martin from New Mexico kind of have also changed the paradigm a little bit? You talked about innovation versus equity. I have a feeling it's now becoming national security versus equity also. Yeah. So I want you to tell our listeners what that means, because they talked about, you know, where China is, and really we just can't, everything else needs to take kind of a backseat versus what we are doing. So a thought from a leader like you on something of that nature.
I think you're right. I think that's exactly what is happening. And, you know, to illustrate it, the panel I keep referencing for your listeners who are wondering what the heck I'm talking about. I was on a panel last week for an organization that wanted to have a conversation around AI. And the panel included myself and someone else from civil society, included someone from, you know, the sort of from the healthcare perspective from Palantir. And then it had someone from the national security side. And it was fascinating because the conversation the individual from the national security side was having versus what I was saying were very different, right? I think from the national security side, there's a sort of a sense of urgency and a sense of, we need to get this out now. You can't stifle, and you cannot stifle the building of these systems. You can't keep tripping. His exact words were, you know, we can't keep tripping over the idea of risk. And from the civil rights side, that's exactly what we're saying. We're saying all this has gigantic risk when it comes to the impact it can have on individuals. And so I think, look, the challenge is, you are right. I agree entirely that you have this sort of these three kind of points that are living out by themselves, right? National security, equity, and innovation. And I think, you know, the argument that we've continued to push is that it's not innovative if it is not equitable. It's not, again, you're not building security if, again, domestically, you have people who are not getting jobs or access to housing. If you are wrongfully arresting people because the systems that we push through because of lack of governance are able to live, you know, freely. So I think it is challenging. I'm not gonna come to you with a perfect answer. I think it's challenging to kind of bring together those three disparate points, because I do think there are valid arguments for why we should be pushing on one side or the other. Obviously, I would say that it is overall better for a company's bottom line to be protective of the users that it's selling its products to. And I think it is, again, we can think about a global perspective and about national security and talk about the threat that countries like China pose in this sort of AI development. But again, look at, and you know, the from a comparative standpoint, look at the government structure. Look at the governance structure of a country like China versus the US, right? As a democracy and as a civil rights organization, it is imperative for us to argue for the safeguarding of democracy as we develop these tools. And so, you know, we'll probably talk about it a little later, but AI and voting is significant to that. And so while I can understand what my colleagues who are kind of coming at it from different perspectives say, for us, if you are, it's not just about like making sure that users aren't getting impacted in a negative way. It's about the whole system of democracy that is could be undermined, right, without like having these tools like developed in a way that is protective of everyone.
KJ, I've had a lot of members of Congress and Senate come on the show, and a lot of them make the argument, and I want you to react to this, is when I bring up this issue that, Sanjay, we have a lot of protections already in place. They say the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the DOJ, the FDA, Housing Authority, etc. It's not like we don't have protections. If there are some gaps, but we already have a lot of laws and protections in place to do this. KJ, how do you react to a lot of members of Congress who come on the show and have made this point?
Well, I would first agree with them that existing laws should definitely apply to AI systems and any sort of, it shouldn't matter where the harm is originating from. Like that, you know, if we need to, you know, uphold those protections, we need to uphold those protections. The challenge is this, right? And this is where I get to, even though I went to law school, my joke is like, I'm not a real lawyer. I just play one on TV. Like, you know, I went to law school, got my license and all that, but I never practiced traditionally. But, you know, the difference between, and I guess before I even jump into trying to, you know, play a lawyer on TV, I'll just do a quick history sort of, you know, reminder for folks. When it comes to something like the Fair Housing Act, there was a time where you would have essentially testers go to an apartment complex, right? Someone who'd be an African-American person, they'd go and ask for a, you know, a lease, a 12-month lease. And the landlord would, the management office or landlord would deny it and say, oh, you know, we already have someone, we're good. And then you'd have another sort of tester from, you know, as a government, you know, agent, a white person come to the same landlord management office and ask for a 12-month lease, and they would get it accepted. And then they would build a case over time. And, you know, that's how the enforcement of that law came into, you know, would come into being. The challenge with automated systems is that we don't always know when we're being harmed or impacted by that, right? If you apply to a job and you get a rejection letter at 3 a.m. in your email inbox, you don't know, you know, it's really hard to tell if that rejection was because of something that some system saw in your resume that, you know, could be potentially, you know, could be a sort of protected class aspect, and it made a decision based off that. And so therefore it's violative of civil rights laws. This example comes a lot with access to benefits, right? The ACLU of New Jersey has been trying to figure out, they're having a lot of people in the state come and saying, hey, we're not getting access to our benefits. And it's these automated systems that we know automated systems are behind the process of determining who gets benefits. We aren't getting them. We should be, but we're not able to kind of clearly connect the dots. So the argument here is that we try to raise is like, look, we understand existing laws are important and we want to uphold those. the EEOC came out with guidance saying that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act would still be enforced, whether it's a tech system. You know, HUD came out with guidance saying that the Fair Housing Act still applies to tech-based systems. But when we're talking about AI governance, we're talking about before the system is even deployed. And we're talking about when you are actually deploying it, how are you actually testing the system for discriminatory impact? So it's a little, you know, I think it's a little bit of a sort of mislead to say it's either or, right? Like, oh, it's either the existing civil rights laws or this is where we're at. Again, these laws, a lot of these laws were passed in the 60s, you know, some of them in the 70s. Like, could we have imagined, could the people who passed those laws even have imagined that we'd be so ingrained with technology in our systems? I don't think they could have. And so it's important for us, just like we update our, you know, any sort of regulations around cars, for example, vehicles on the road, mm-hmm. going from horse and buggy to, you know, having, you know, engines to requiring seatbelts. Now we have automated vehicles on the road. Like, you're going to need the ability to update regulations. And so the conversation we're having is really about updating existing protections to make them more sort of applicable, and not about saying, let's ignore the old laws.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. You know, how do we make sure that civil society organizations like yours, I mean, do you think they have a role to play in shaping AI regulations and policies, KJ?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we have been part of those conversations. Again, you know, we have, like, our coalition is 240 groups. So we're all, not every group is focused on tech and telecom, but we do have a, you know, a media telecom task force that has a number of those coalition members sitting on that. We have a civil rights table that has a number of coalition organizations sitting on that. And then we have tech policy organizations that are not really part of our 240 coalition group, but they are in the tech policy space and we work closely with them. These are the folks who, frankly, have more of the technical expertise sometimes, right? They have technologists who, like, work in the companies and are now advising civil society on this. So it's already happening. It's important for us to have that space. And I'll be honest, like, I do think, you know, you are seeing much more receptivity from Congress to garner, like, widespread feedback. We see that when we're talking about the roadmap, but all the AI bills you talked about, many of those bills, those authors come and talk to our office about getting feedback on where they can strengthen it. And, you know, when there are multiple hearings happening as well on AI bills or even national security and AI, something that we said maybe hard to connect the dots, we know that we've had conversations with committee staff on how do they make sure that they're representing the civil society perspective there. So I definitely think it's important to continue that tradition.
KJ, I asked this to members of Congress, and I'll, after you give me your answer, I'll tell you what they say is, do you advocate for an independent regulatory body for AI?
That's right.
I've asked this to every member of Congress and Senate, but I won't tell you their answer till you tell me yours.
Our comms professionals on the call, so hopefully I don't get in any trouble here. I will say that
we can dodge it if you want.
No, it's not that serious. I'm just joking around. Like, I think there are organizations that have an official stance on this. I know that we have partner organizations that are very gung-ho. We need to create an independent agency to, stack it with experts and all that. I would say my personal experience of working in government and policy is that it is very challenging to stand up a new agency and to ensure that it has consistent, robust funding. We saw the Supreme Court decision come out, I believe today's Monday, come out last week, that essentially said that the CFPB's funding structure is still upheld. And so when that agency is illustrated example for me of how tough it is to maintain and, you know, keep building existing structures, existing sort of branches of government. What we do support, and I'm forgetting the name of the bill off the top of my head, but it's a Senator Markey bill that essentially talks about making like stacking each existing agency with technologists and with a dedicated civil rights office that focuses on the intersection of tech and whatever that issue is. I think that's a strong model of where we should be thinking about. I think, like, do I think conceptually, is it important to create a whole independent body to really be focused with experts and to have them come into? Sure, I think conceptually it's a great idea. But even the AI executive, you know, order, when the OMB memo was launched and I had, you know, I was invited to speak at the White House before these chief AI officers, I could see the sort of the, just the disparate agencies, right? The different groups that they all represent. You have the agriculture in the room with DOJ and you know, Health and Human Services, trying to then create like another independent agency to then be part of government as a whole, but also be focused on this critical area is challenging. So I don't think you'd get an endorsement from KJ Bakshi to create an independent body, but I, you know, respect our colleagues who are really focusing on kind of moving that agenda forward.
So I'll give you the answer that majority answer, and it was exactly what you said. They said in this town, firstly, the bureaucracy and getting people to agree on an agency, as you said, they've been fighting this CFPB for what, 10? How long has CFPB been around, man? 10 years?
Yeah.
At least?
About, yeah.
So think about it. So the answer from every member of Congress, even some who said it was a good idea, they said cannot happen. So that is definitely an issue. Now, you talked about maybe having each agency having expertise and stuff. Now, didn't OMB make it mandatory to have the chief AI officers? But you're saying advocating a separate civil rights office along with that, just for our listeners, can you clarify what you're asking?
So this is like, again, like I mean, you are quoting me because I'm on your podcast, but I believe the proposal that came from the legislative branch, right, from Congress was, this bill was essentially to have each agency have a dedicated civil rights office that would be focused on those issues and also to staff each of those agencies with tech experts to focus on these issues. I do think, yes, you're right. The OMB memo, the AI executive order calls on, right, appointing chief AI officers, which was huge. And then on, you know, creating interagency working groups and all that. I will just, my one critique of that, of what we saw with the AI executive order, is that some agencies appointed real experts to be their chief AI officers, right? People who really have the technical skills and understand the intersection between their agency and civil rights. And we work with those chief AI officers closely. But then you also have agencies that have major impacts on individuals that have large budgets, and their chief AI officer are essentially folks who were kind of given an additional responsibility, right? They were the chief sort of financial officer. They sort of more on the operations side of the agency. Yeah. And because they had oversight over the whole agency, the thinking was, well, let's just give you this task you with this as well. I think, and it's like they have to, right? The AI executive order has a very short timeline, and you know, maybe there isn't enough time to bring in the experts to really head up these efforts. But again, creating the, that's why the legislative approach to us is a little more intriguing, because it's saying bring in real experts into this effort. And you know, look, it goes without saying, the thing with any executive order is that if the political winds change and we have someone else in the White House, then that can sort of dismantle some of the changes that have already happened that we're seeing under this administration. And that's why, again, like taking that legislative approach is something where, again, we would really like stress that.
No, that's, I think you made some excellent points about the chief AI officer. In terms of KJ, let's talk about workforce. You know, there's, KJ, all kinds of statistics thrown around. McKinsey, IMF, 60% of the workforce could get disrupted, this, that. We have a digital divide in our country. Some people warn of an AI divide. And now with this massive transformation that could be coming, is that something your organization is looking at as to how AI could have, you know, an impact on, you know, the workforce, on the diversity of the workforce, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We have a number of labor organizations, including the AFL-CIO, that sit as part of our coalition. And so when we talk about workforce and the impact on the workforce with AI, we definitely, you know, we're keeping them in mind. And I'll also say that there are organizations that are focused on specific constituencies, such as the Asian community or the Latino community, that are getting investment from the private sector to start thinking through creating more AI literacy to help develop the future workforce training. So this is definitely something on our mind. I think we think literacy is really one step But I do think looking at existing sort of statutory frameworks that focus on industries that are impacted, right, by job displacement. And so how do you kind of look at funding those mechanisms? The example I can give you is from my previous role at the Trade Association, where we were working with a lot of trucking folks who represent like truckers, who were concerned that the development of AI in vehicles, autonomous vehicles, especially in trucking, would start displacing some of like what's impacting these drivers. And so the conversation that a lot of folks were having behind closed doors, it never came into fruition and never moved into a bill that could move through the market process into the floor. But the conversations were about funding these grants that exist for displaced industries, right? They're usually meant to kind of impact sort of when an emergency happens and like a mining community is impacted or something like that, right? To fund, like to help with the transition on that process. So I think we need to be cognizant that current forecasts for what the impact on different communities will be in the workforce, I think it is still early to tell. I think I'm a little different from some of my colleagues in the space who are much more sort of, you know, ringing the bell and saying, look, we need to think about this today. I agree we should be thinking about it today. But I also do think that if we start thinking through developing strong literacy, which, by the way, is not just about AI, right? Even access to these systems and broadband, which is another issue we focus on, making sure that the folks, you know, children in schools are actually getting access to these systems and tools at home because they have internet access, to make them more comfortable with it so that they can play with it in a workforce, is critical as well. And so I do think, you know, long story short, I would say we do think about these issues. I also do think that the numbers are still early to tell, but the solution can't just be focused on literacy and training. It has to be focused on what actually does happen to those who will be displaced because their jobs are impacted by it. And I will say that the one statistic I will continue to kind of stress and agree with is that those industries that will be impacted are most more than likely going to be those industries that have a high number of people of color in those roles. And so how do we ensure that there's a inability to ensure that those communities are taken care of and protected is a tough conversation to have with some people, because these tools they're not all out there yet. We're not seeing all the job displacement that folks are forecasting. So I'm not super conservative like some folks are. I'm also not as forthright and saying like, look, like this is all going to happen. Like we're basically screwed at this point. I think there's an ability to start kind of curbing some of that as we think through what the future of work looks like.
KJ, I talk to a lot of C-level execs of enterprises, and I ask them, and most of the Fortune 500 companies today have an ethics board. They say AI ethics board to guard against biases, etc., etc. The reason I'm asking you that is, should there be, in your view, independent audits and some kind of an oversight mechanism to monitor AI systems, you think, for potential civil rights violations?
I think it depends on how you're framing it, right? Like I think, so I'll point to the AI executive order and then the OMB memo that came out, kind of creating an instruction manual for how agencies should follow this AI executive order. There are two categories that the memo specifically calls out, and that is technology that is safety impacting and technology that is rights impacting. And so it essentially calls for and says, like, look, if this tool is somehow rights impacting, here's the criteria of how you analyze this tool. Here's what you do if the tool is found to be discriminatory. So should that work be designated to an independent board in a company, or should it be a federal sort of entity? You know, that I think has to be sort of fleshed out in conversation. I think two things come to mind, right? One is like the fact that private sector is saying like, look, we're already doing this, a lot of this compliance on our own. So either leave us alone, right? Don't make it harder on us, or B, we welcome it, right? We're already doing this. Cool, like create whatever guidance you want. We want to know how we can strengthen our own internal challenges. I think that's, you know, kind of naming the sort of landscape, that there are companies that have come out saying like AI governance conversations, let's have it. I do think though, going back to the earlier point, if you have a bottom line that you need to protect, I don't think having companies be sort of self-reliant on their own enforcement and compliance is going to be enough. I do think there needs to be something in law or, you know, through an executive order, if it's about procurement with the government, that creates stronger guardrails. Now, who does that? Analyzing, I think, depends. I think if you're the executive, you know, if you're the executive branch and you're an agency buying a tool, let's say like facial recognition technology, for example, if you're buying a new system, then you need to follow the guidelines that are in the OMB guidance, right? Because you're the one procuring it. If you're a developer, there should be guidance that you can look to, like, all right, we want to make sure that this is what our assessment says. If you're a deployer, if you're the one putting it out in the market, how do we make sure that you have your guardrails? So who the person should be, I think, is an interesting conversation. I don't think it should be left to private, you know, sector alone. I think we've seen with data in 2017, you know, what happened with Cambridge Analytica, that, you know, as moderate as I may be in criticizing companies overall, I don't think companies can be left to their own devices in something that is as important as protecting our civil rights.
Okay. So some kind of an oversight is what you're saying should be there. It can't be just the companies. Since we talked about companies, KJ, this is also a question I ask senators and members of Congress, that look at what's happened in social media. We have basically 5, 6, 7, 8 companies that control our town hall, town square of democracy. Do you worry the same thing could be the case in AI? A few Silicon Valley companies, maybe a French company, a token French company here and there, maybe one German company, basically, and 3-4 Silicon Valley companies. And implications of that thought process?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I cut you. I was trying to jump in. Yes, I agree. Yeah, everything you just said, I agree with. I think that's why we support the Create AI Act. We haven't formally endorsed it, but it is a bill that we support that talks about significant investment of government resources into creating. And I know, I believe the frame, the roadmap that you, that we're talking about, the Senate AI roadmap, references this a little bit. Yeah. So I do think that government investment is critical here. We all in this space know that it takes a lot of data, it takes a lot of computing power to create these tools. And there's a reason why big tech companies are the ones who are kind of like holding the gate right now. So again, I do think major investment is critical to ensure that smaller entrants or mid-sized entrants can actually start developing some of these tools, kind of access to some of that computing power, and to kind of to be competitive. I do think there is a competition argument to make, but it's also, you know, and again, and this is coming from my opinion, leadership conference does not work on competition issues officially, but just as it impacts, you know, diverse communities, for us to have multiple choices, right? We see that Twitter, now X, completely changed their content moderation policies after Elon Musk took over. And you see people leaving that to be like, all right, well, we're going to either utilize Instagram more, or we're going to use Threads, we're going to just use Signal, you know, as the way to communicate. We're going to use, you know, iMessage group chat, because we want to talk to people and let people know what's up. But we also understand that we don't like this one option. So I think options are critical. I think you're seeing it a little bit, not as aggressively, but in the web browser space, right? You have DuckDuckGo, you have Mozilla trying to be like, look, we have better data collection practices than our competitors in the space. But it's like, I think choices are always good, right? And I think we don't want to create the same issue that we saw with some of the sort of social media. I don't know if I agree with the sort of town hall sort of assessment, but I do agree that we saw what happened in 2017 is because you have like one or two major platforms really controlling like how people are exchanging information about the election.
Yeah. KJ, want to talk about international collaboration. Most companies these days are global. So you have the EU AI Act, as a member of Congress told me 2 weeks ago, that the Europeans are regulatory superpowers. We are innovation superpowers. We don't seem to have an act now. There are 20 states who are putting together some kind of a regulation. China has its own thing, etc. Is that something that's of impact to your organization, etc., or do you think harmonization of regulation or at least some kind of governance would be helpful in that sense?
I do think, I mean, so first, I think we have to give a shout out to Colorado, right? That passed the first governance law. I think it's just like very recent news. And the approach they took is interesting, saying that developers and deployers exercise reasonable care when it comes to high risk systems. And they have their definition of what high risk is. So I think that's what we're going to see more of. I think while Congress sort of delays, you see states are going to try to fill that void. I will just use the privacy argument as the privacy debate as a sort of comparative point. I haven't seen states or even Congress be motivated as a body by like what's happening in other countries, right? I haven't seen that model for multiple reasons, right? We also have a constitution, so we have a lot of First Amendment protections. And so what sort of impositions can be placed on companies, you know, and how the constitutional protections might be implicated always comes into play in our conversations versus the EU. I'm not convinced that we need a sort of global standard, because I've seen how with the GDPR coming into play, they're doing just fine enforcing their side, right? Now, people debate like how effective GDPR is versus not, but my point is they have that sort of mechanism there, and we see it on the US side when we have to click on cookies or accept cookies and all the other sort of transparency items. So I think you can have frameworks, you know, that, and you know, countrywide that allow users to come and interface. But I do think that the US, I think the other point that I really try to stress is that I think we're uniquely positioned given the grand diversity we have and the history of how, you know, data has been collected on marginalized communities, how it is sold to data brokers. I mean, the stories are fascinating and also horrifying, right? You have stories about data brokers using Muslim dating apps to collect information and then selling that to the Department of Homeland Security to help DHS surveil Muslim communities in certain areas. So when I think about impacts on our sort of like communities of color or marginalized groups or minority communities, I do think that because we're uniquely situated there, I do think that the governance here has to be very focused on making sure that we're all protected overall versus what I think would be essentially sort of like a copy paste of like what other countries are doing, which is like they're governing their own bodies. And that's, you know, important to do. I think we need governance overall. I do think, but again, my sort of amateur observation of Congress is that I don't see members of Congress being like, man, we need to hurry up because the EU did this, or man, the EU AI Act has this, so we need to do this as well. I think in conversations with allies, you may see Senator Klobuchar and others sort of commending what is happening on this side. But overall, like, I think we're just in a, for better or for worse, we're very much like focused on our own protections and systems. And so while I think we should look at foreign countries as potential models to take from that and learn from it, I do think that because of our unique constituency and population, you know, we need to really be focused on that instead of just thinking about governance just for governance sake.
So focus on our stuff. KJ, I think that's what you're saying. KJ, early on, you alluded to our elections and the role of AI, deepfakes, etc., in our elections. We had, during the New Hampshire primary, as you know, there were robocalls and things like that that were done using AI, etc. Your thoughts on the whole issue of democracy, and you know, the worries across the world, there are about 60 elections that are happening or in the process of happening. What are your thoughts, and how does your organization, or how do you think about that?
Sure. So we are definitely very focused on the intersection of AI and voting. The AI roadmap talking about putting more investment into election systems across the country to make sure that they're better equipped to kind of handle the spread of, you know, AI powered misinfo, disinformation, or, you know, even attacks on their systems, like on just the election system itself, is something that we definitely are very supportive of. I think what we have seen, and I keep going back to Cambridge Analytica, because I think that was a sort of a strong illustrative example of how foreign powers that were trying to sort of interfere, or even domestic, you know, it could have been domestic actors as well. There's folks are kind of, you know, have their own opinion on that. But the point is, when you have an election and you have folks who are coming from, like, say, the African-American community, and you have, you know, you have, what do they call them? I'm forgetting the name now, like Facebook groups, right? That would essentially be like, this is for Black Lives Matter, and getting here, like, come to this place and rally. And then you have that same individual data being used that's been collected to get folks who are showing sort of antipathy or aggression against Black Lives Matter, that movement, and creating work, you know, groups there to, like, get folks who are against this ideology and saying, hey, come to this place at this time, and being used to, like, create tension and aggression there. We've seen how that has happened. And so I think for us, when we think about the impact AI has, it's really about manipulation and about the spread of disinformation and misinformation to either dissuade folks from voting or showing up to the voting booth on the right day, the right time. So I think, you know, there are a few things that we're doing, right, beyond supporting legislation that is coming out. We also do have a in-house boiler room operation that is tracking election related disinformation, misinformation on the major platforms. And we work with our partners in the space, including Spitfire Strategies, to create inoculation messaging. Mm-hmm. And then we spread that out to our various networks that are focused, you know, that are on the ground. So that is direct. That is our most, I would say, one of our most aggressive sort of grassroots approaches to fighting disinfo, misinfo, is to create this inoculation messaging and then disseminating it across the systems. What we're planning on doing this year is sort of very specific community focused trainings on how to fight disinfo, misinfo. So for the African-American community, for the Latino community, for the AAPI community, because we've seen that disinformation spreads differently among different communities, even though the result may be the same. So for the AAPI community, for example, you have a lot of folks from China using WeChat, right? You have folks from South Asia using WhatsApp. And so you see that how things can spread very quickly on those mechanisms. So how do we empower folks who are on the ground to sort of help counter some of that? That's something that we're also very invested in. So beyond legislation, which is tough because, again, elections don't just happen federally. You're also having local and statewide elections. Yeah. It's really about the individual impact there.
Well, that's great. So you're prepared. You have a war room. And this is obviously a big concern because our democracy is very, very valuable. KJ, finally, I mean, I have like a zillion questions. We'll need to get you back there. But I also value your time. Finally, what advice would you give to the policymakers and regulators who are listening? And we have a lot of, by the way, EU and other countries' regulators also who listen, as they are navigating the complex landscape of AI governance and civil rights.
Yeah, no, that's great. And, like, and I want to just respond to what you were saying earlier. I'm always happy to come back and chat more. I think this has been a great conversation. You really covered quite a bit, and you gave sort of
I took you in so many ways, and there were so many other ways I wanted to take you, but please, yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm always here for the ride. So yeah, whenever you're ready, I'm happy to come back. I'll say, look, I think we're seeing models of what good AI governance can look like. And I would just point people to the policymakers and so on, to the approach that the Colorado law takes, which is talking about, it's not about overall any system that uses AI and trying to take it from that approach, because that becomes difficult. How do you define AI? At what point do you come in? But thinking about impact, taking an impact-based approach, which is what the Colorado law tries to take on, right? By saying, if you're a high-risk system that, you know, then, and they define what a high-risk system is, then, you know, developers and deployers have to they have to exercise reasonable care. I think on a stronger note, you see in the OMB memo that talks about the AI executive order, that says, like, look, if your system is going to be rights impacting or safety impacting, you have to go through these criteria. And so when you take a more impact-based approach towards legislating, it is much more sort of tangible and concrete. I think when folks are trying to go into take it from, like, the maybe more linear approach, like, let's define AI and what's an AI system and what's not an AI system. We've had folks from different states reach out to us asking us, like, in our legislation, we're defining AI like this. What do you think? And we'll give them feedback and be like, well, look, in this context, you're not really capturing XYZ when you define it like this. And so, you know, we're always happy to be a resource to folks and we give feedback that way. But if I were to wave a sort of magic wand and you know, have policymakers follow my suggestions, I'd say, like, look, take a very core impact-based approach and also make sure that civil rights is explicitly called out and that any system that has a disparate impact or a negative impact on someone's individual and civil their civil rights needs to just be completely, you know, that's be prohibited. I think you can build a base from that, right? Once you protect individuals, then you can think about what does transparency look like? What does accountability look like? What does fairness look like? What does equity look like? But the base has to be impact. You're impacting people with these systems. And, you know, I would just, we remind members all the time when we talk to them, and I would just remind your, you know, your listeners about that as well.
Well, that's great. So impact-based, just make sure they do that. KJ, didn't the Colorado legislation kind of follow Connecticut sort of, was it kind of, I mean, Connecticut didn't happen, but they followed Connecticut, right?
I'm not, so that, okay. I don't want to interrupt any Colorado worries. Or Connecticut listeners, so okay. I'm not going to, but I do think that Connecticut was, you're right, they were on the approach. The last I saw was the governor of Connecticut felt that. Yeah. They were kind of moving too quickly and they wanted to let us kind of allow more innovation to flourish for building governance. I think based on everything I've been saying for the past hour, that's clearly not our approach or our mentality, but, you know, we leave it to the state legislatures to get back in the game and to, you know, follow Colorado's lead and start developing strong legislation. But, you know, final point before I turn it over to you. You know, baseline legislation, federal baseline legislation is always what we're advocating for first and foremost for that. We, you know, whether you're in Colorado, Nevada, you as a user should know what your rights are. You should have a reasonable expectation of what you, when you interact with the system of any kind, what you can ask for and what you can see. And that only happens through federal baseline legislation, privacy or AI governance.
Awesome. Thank you, KJ, really for sharing such valuable insights and perspectives, you know, today with us. You know, your dedication to ensuring that civil rights remains at the forefront of AI formulation is truly commendable. And to our listeners, I hope this conversation has provided you with a much deeper understanding of the complex interplay between AI and civil rights and the importance of proactive regulation and governance to safeguard our fundamental rights and freedoms. Thank you for tuning into Regulating AI. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep advocating for a just and equitable future. Thank you, KJ. This was fabulous. As I could have just gone on for at least an hour more, really, we need to have you back again. Thank you.
Thank you. No, thank you to you and your team. This was great.
Thank you.